offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, welcome to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, welcoming you is Prem and Hari. We're going to continue with the 12th discourse, the penultimate discourse in the series, the 1991 Samakos series, the discourse that Swami delivered on the 1st of June, 1991. As we've seen in the many discourses that we have gone through, the theme of this entire series is on the Upanishads, the Vedantic declarations as given in the various Upanishads. But this particular discourse is a very general one where Swami speaks about sadhana. The Vedanta always speaks about what is the ultimate state we are all progressing towards, and Swami says that sadhana is that path. What are we supposed to do? And this discourse is about that. Swami speaks about what we are supposed to look for when we say that I would wish to take up a life of sadhana, I would like to take up some activities in the name of sadhana. That's what this discourse is all about. Very, very beautiful points already made, and I think some of the points that Swami made in the clip which we played last time, we couldn't really dwell into that. But before all of that, and before we play the clip which we have for this week's episode, I invite Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Prem. Sorry.
And this discourse, of course, Swami lays down very beautifully what he means by sadhana itself. And he says to transform bad into good is true spiritual practice. To turn happiness into sorrow.
Sorry. Sorrow into happiness.
I think I made the same mistake last week, to beg your pardon. To convert sorrow into happiness. And Swami says not only that is a transformation part. Then Swami says sadhana is also meant for maintaining something which has already been attained, or for retaining a blessing which has been given, and for progress too. Swami says that if you don't do sadhana, you fall back into that lower state from which you've risen, and to rise further again, you need to continue to do sadhana.
Right. So we were actually also looking at deeply into the just those two statements, no? To transform bad into good, and
right.
to turn sorrow into happiness.
Right.
And how it led very beautifully into Swami speaking about acceptance of sorrow also as an integral part of our existence. Because most of the time we are tuned, you know, as human beings or as living beings, we are tuned to turn towards happiness and run away from sorrow. But Swami is teaching us like how sorrow itself has so many things, so many lessons that strengthen a person's personality, a psyche of a person. And I was reading, you know, a couple of months back about a concept in leadership. This is a thought, you know, of some of people who analyzed the lives of leaders, and they found that in many of them, there was this what they call as a crucial experience, which they named as a crucible.
Okay.
So the crucible is like, so the person at some point of time in his life, they have undergone like tribulations or very tough situation, from which they emerge stronger, and that kind of defined their leadership style, you know. And so in the eyes of others, these were people who are not, you know, normally buffeted by something that ordinary people would get buffeted by, and so people started looking up to them, and that's how they become, you know, like true leaders, right? And one very classic example would be Gandhiji himself, right? So those tough experiences which he went through, it's very easy to see like how they made him who he was,
right?
You know, later. And I see that in very many remarkable people also. A few days ago, I was looking at now a person who's now become a very popular comedy news show host in the United States, Trevor Noah. And I just, so even as you watch him, although he's a comic, you know, one thing that always used to be apparent is that there's a lot of strength behind him. So I was wondering, you know, what is it like? So then I see, you know, he was born in South Africa in a period of apartheid, where his one parent was colored, and whereas his other parent was not.
Okay.
Right. I think his father was white and his mother was from the Negro community. And so because of this, there was so much racial tension, you know, especially he in his own country was, you know, considered somebody who's like an illegal, illegal child. So his title, the title of his book is Born a Crime, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So having gone through like so many such experiences, and now you can see the amount of maturity in such a very young person. He must be in his like early 20s or late 20s or 30s, but you can already see enormous strength in that person, right? And that's a result of not wilting under that kind of attacks which, you know, destiny dealt him with.
Right. One thing is that, and the other thing which Swami mentions even in this discourse is, you know, it is sorrow which actually makes happiness sweeter. That's what Swami says. And many times when you look at these personalities, what really makes their achievement stand out is these challenges they've gone through.
Yeah.
You know, you always hold these as examples. You know, say, you know what, there was a failure and then there was the success. I always like this example of somebody like APJ Abdul Kalam. You know, he writes, I think one of his last books he reveals that he always had the dream of becoming a fighter pilot. Okay, he would always say that I want to become a fighter pilot. And when he goes for the interview, he says that there were 18 posts which they were filling and he came 19th, 8th or 9th, 8th or 18th, I don't recall correctly. So he just misses it. But the other interview which he goes to was for the space research program. There he excels. I mean, it is like, he of course says that it is then that I realized that they are looking for something more in a pilot, which I did not develop in myself till that point in time. But he says that my career starts with a disappointment like this. And if you look at the entire thing, a person who wanted to become a fighter pilot in the defense forces eventually ends up being the leader of all the defense forces in the country. Right? You know, that's really a fairy tale story. So what makes it stand out is this disappointment or this difficulty which, you know, which literally paves the way to success.
Right.
And that's what Swami is saying. It makes it sweeter, so never turn away from sorrow.
Yes. Of course, one point, you know, I think we should always bear in mind that the happiness which we are talking about, right, and I think this is a point the Upanishads do make from time to time, is very distinct from, see, for us happiness means something that is associated with a physical state, right? We feel, when we say we feel happy about something, it's like a reaction deep within us, like deep within our brain, right? Which it happens for some time and subsides, and so it's like a phase which we go through. But this, they say, is just a very poor mirror of what actual bliss the Upanishads are speaking about, or what the Indian scriptures are speaking about. And so there's a little caveat, therefore, like when we talk of sadhana, this sadhana is not in pursuit of, you know, this elusive happiness. The world is, as Swami has made this point time and again, it is a mixture of happiness and sorrow. There is joy, you know, there is victory and defeat. And there is sometimes winning and there's sometimes losing. And that will happen. Right? There is, the sadhana's aim is not to therefore completely eliminate any possibility of defeat and always ensure victory, for example. Right? And because the victory here is a greater victory, as the Gita points out, it is to rise above all of this.
Right.
Right? Or rather, to get to that state where you truly are, where you are actually above all of...
It's a very important point that you make, because many times the comparison of the kind of happiness that you get in a spiritual path is actually an extension of what you find in regular life.
Right.
You know, something like meditation, as somebody was pointing out. The meditation as a technique will give you a certain amount of peace of mind. Whether you attain that spiritual benefit or not is actually... It's beyond that. But even for anybody who does meditation as a technique, like when Swami was talking about the Pranava Mantra, Swami was saying that you don't know anything what it will grant you. You don't have any higher benefits in mind. But if you chant Pranava Mantra, you will get physical benefits. Right? And what we generally do is we compare worldly benefits with worldly benefits which can be attained through a spiritual path. And we say that it's equal. You know, why do I need sadhana? But as you're pointing out, sadhana is taken up even to transcend this,
right.
Even to transcend the happiness which is found through the path of sadhana itself.
Correct.
Which is actually a very important point, and I think I made this mention before of this sadhu who is giving a satsang, and at the end of the satsang, one of the devotees walks up to him, one of the people who's a householder who comes and attends these satsangs. And he comes and says, Guruji, today's satsang was amazing. It was very nice. Bahut maza aaya, he says. And the guru takes strong offense to that. He says, was I serving gulab jamun? What do you mean by saying that you enjoyed it? This is not for enjoyment. Right? You may enjoy it. Right? Because sometimes when you read when you listen to something intellectually stimulating, you enjoy it. But he says that this is not for enjoyment. Don't bring it down to the level of enjoyment that you experience in everyday life.
Also, I think briefly we'll touch upon what we spoke about last time about sorrow, right? So how Swami says, of course, that sorrow is not pushed upon us by someone else, which is again a very important point. And right, very next statement, Swami says again, bad thoughts and misery are not thrust into our heads from outside. So bad and sorrow, they occur very naturally, which is a very important point again, that which we are making. The world is the way it is, right? And we cannot wish it away. And from time to time we keep fancying that that it one day it will all turn into quite something else, right? But the fact of the matter, and Swami puts it very starkly, is that these are such an integral part of your life. Right, they will be there, and that's why it is very important to, as we noted last time, to look at very carefully what Swami means when he says to transform bad into good. Right, and that transformation can occur nowhere else but within ourselves. It's not that the world will suddenly transform into something. To be able to see good in what the world sees as bad, right, and to convert, to transform sorrow into happiness. And Swami says that is the true spiritual practice. Because even the Gita says in the end, the qualifying virtue of a devotee is finally the equanimity.
Right.
Where, as we said, we go beyond, joy and sorrow, and those things, right? The profit and loss and...
Again, when Swami speaks about transforming sorrow into happiness, that's the point. It's not about discarding sorrow or running away from sorrow, as you're pointing out, and seeking happiness. In fact, I always like to give this example of, let's say that you're having some ailment and you go to a doctor, and the doctor gives you a medicine. And the next morning you wake up with very high fever, and you're having body pains or stomach pain or something, and you're having high fever. You panic and you call up the doctor, saying that I'm running high fever. What is it supposed to mean? And the doctor says, don't worry, actually, that's a good sign, which means the medicine is working.
Right?
So you're in pain, but you know that that pain has a purpose to it.
Right.
And that gives you a higher, a kind of happiness which is above the pain itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that is the happiness that Swami is talking about transforming sorrow into. When you see that there is a purpose for sorrow, there is a reason for sorrow to be there, it's not that you wish away the sorrow or you discard the sorrow altogether, but you find the happiness which is a step higher than this sorrow and comfort.
Correct.
Which you experience.
No, because a doctor would be very encouraged when you say that you have a fever, because that is the sign that the body
immunity
is actually fighting back,
right,
against the infection. So similarly, like the Swami also asks us to look at sorrow as basically, something... It is, so they say, pain, for example, in the body is an indication that you are up to something that is not good for the body.
Right.
So similarly, sorrow is that, indication that you are up to something which essentially is not good for you. It's like a wake-up call that you got to turn your, direction.
Right.
For some, it could be as simple as, reminding them that you have forgotten the existence of God Himself.
Very true.
That like a very nice example which is there in the Mahabharata, and God could be right in front of you and you could forget Him, right? So at the end of the Mahabharata, when the war has concluded, right, and all the 18 days of the war, it was Lord Krishna who's been the charioteer of Arjuna. And so on the very last day, as was the daily practice, so what Lord Krishna had instructed Arjuna was that at the end of the day, when we return to the war camp, it is Arjuna who has to first get off the chariot and then Krishna will get off.
Mm.
So these were his instructions. And Arjuna, he had followed it every single day till the day victory went to his head. And on that day, you know, with that intoxication of victory, when Krishna says, okay, now get off the chariot, as we've been doing all this while, at that moment he suddenly remembers, he says, but you are the charioteer and I am the owner of this chariot. I think it should be you who should get off first and then next I. And then, Lord Krishna says, like, don't be a fool, watch what is going to happen. And then Arjuna comes to his senses, he gets off, and the moment Krishna also gets off the chariot bursts into flames. And then Krishna explains, if you think that you are such a hero, you should know that there were so many arrows that were aimed at you which I have absorbed with my power. Right? And had I unleashed even a little bit of it in your direction, you would not have survived. And that is what you are seeing here, that explosion was a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times, like, we do forget the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes the, you know, life itself tends to remind you that you have become so arrogant, you are blithely, you know, moving through life. You've forgotten the existence of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very gentle reminder. And so it just needs for us to be in tune with Lord himself.
One of the old students were saying, I think this student had to, because of some domestic problems, leave Patti and he had to go back and take care of his parents or whatever. I mean, he felt that it was an emergency and he needed to go. So he had to take Swami's permission that he wants to leave his job and go back and stay with his parents. Much later, this person was recollecting the thing. He said when he told that to Swami, there was disbelief on Swami's face.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, that's the only word I can think of. Because Swami was confounded, you know, why would you want to do that? And he says, now when he thinks back at that moment, he says, what fools we are. Swami is in front of us. Nobody is going to take care of our affairs better than Swami. And you're going to Swami and saying, Swami, you know what, I have problem at home. I'll have to go and look into those things. So please relieve me. And he said, that time I didn't understand. Why is it so difficult for Swami to understand that as a son, this is my duty. And I have to go back and, you know, take care of my home. But he said, now when I look back, you know, what fools we are. We go and tell Swami that, forgetting that Swami is the one who's going to set every affair of yours right. You know, when you say that, even when Swami is in front of you, you tend to forget. And most of the time, at least for us Swami's devotees, I think the sorrow comes because we forget Swami.
Exactly.
It's not anything else.
Yeah, I found that very often, happening, like, especially in the, like, in recent years, you know, it is quite easy to suddenly think that, you know, like, we get so immersed in our work or something like that, and we tend to forget Swami. I've seen, you know, whenever that phase occurs, he always finds a way to say, okay, I think you're straying a little too much, and I'll find, you know, like, gentle reminder, you got to come back and get in tune with me. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is very true. It's also his kindness, you know, in a way that he keeps us in touch with him instead of us making, you know, having to make that
going
effort.
Back to the example of Krishna and Arjuna, that very beautiful episode of after Krishna kills Karna. Right? That's when he realizes that actually Karna was his elder brother, because Mother Kunti comes running. So after that he says, oh my God, I've killed my elder brother, what a sinner I am. So apparently Krishna starts laughing. So he says, see, he had a armor which he was born with. I ensured that was removed from him. I ensured that, you know, the guru curses him that at the moment when he needs, he will not be able to use his weapons. And he says, I ensured that Mother Earth will conspire against him. And he gives four or five such instances. He says, I have killed him five times before you killed him the sixth time. He says, literally what you've done is stamp on a dead snake. And you say that, you know, you are the sinner. What a fool you are. He says, you know, I think we'll go ahead because, but one point which Swami made, which probably Swami will elaborate on, is the point that sadhana is also to maintain what you've already achieved. As you had mentioned, you know, even with small vessels, you need to always maintain them. A silver vessel has to be maintained constantly to ensure that its brightness is kept. An analogy I can think of is, you know, probably like riding a bicycle. right? Sadhana is probably equivalent to riding a bicycle, because to remain stable and to move forward, you need to do the same action.
Hmm.
If you stop pedaling, you can't move forward, nor can you remain in balance.
Correct.
So sadhana is literally like that. To remain at the state where you are and to progress, you need to do sadhana. That's what Swami was saying.
Right.
So I think we'll go to the third clip in that discourse and let's see what Swami has to say.
Innately, creation is manifested along with bad in the world. Out of this bad emerges the good. Without bad, there is no possibility for the manifestation of good. When we aspire for something, a related disappointment will be the reason for it. Human life is a combination of desires and disappointments. Human life is also a combination of thoughts and doubts. Human life is a combination of union and separation. What is this samsara or worldly existence? It is the vast ocean made of waves of unions and separations. It is in such an ocean we can find the valuable gems and pearls. Only when we face and endure these obstacles and move forward, it's possible for us to attain the divine state. Instead, if we get perturbed and frightened and do not put in any efforts and channelize them in the right direction, our life would be wasted. There will be many obstacles in our life. Without such obstacles, humanity would be valueless. Therefore, that which adds value to humanity are sorrow, unrest, and bad.
They give value to man's
life. It is said, result is obtained only through hardship. If there are no difficulties, we would not obtain the true results. A simple saying goes, in this world, everything can be attained through spiritual practice. When we say sadhana, this is what we need to do. Convert bad to good. Convert sorrow into happiness. Transform bad into good. For this, mind is most essential. Man is failing to recognize the immense abilities and potency of the mind. For all happiness and sorrow, mind is the main reason. It is not possible for anyone to explain the divine power inherent in the mind as such and such. The nature of the mind is beyond description. In a trice, it reaches everywhere. In an instant, it can become still. In an instant, it blossoms. In an instant, it fades away. Therefore, one is bound to the world by actions, and the mind is bound to human nature. The world is bound through the mind.
Manomoolam idam jagat.
Mind is the root cause for creation.
Manchi chettalaku manase moola karanam.
For both good and bad, mind is the root cause.
Manam aaharam teesukuntunnam anukondi. Ee aaharam jeernipabadi dehaniki pushtini santushtini andistunnadani manam bhavistunnamu.
Consider this. When we partake food, we believe that this food, once digested, gives strength and satisfaction to the body. But it is not the food that is giving strength and satisfaction. It is the mind. While partaking food, if the mind is not cheerful, joyful and happy, the food can turn into poison. So, it is the mind that accords sacred divinity to the human nature. We should try to contemplate in a sacred manner whatever we may do, see, tell or think. Therefore, in human life, without the mind's prompting, we cannot begin any activity. The effect of thoughts is responsible for happiness and joy in human life. Man gloats foolishly relying upon his power of the muscle, intelligence, wealth, authority and intellect. But we are not trying to understand how this great demon of ego hiding inside misleads us onto the wrong path.
And that was the third clip in that discourse. For those of you who have not been following us, it's a retranslation of the discourses that Swami delivered on that day. We had Radio Sai Sunil giving the voice for the translation there. Swami continues with whatever we were speaking about in the second clip, where the importance of accepting sorrow, which is a very important thing which Swami is talking about.
Because Swami makes it very clear here. No? He says, one's life is a series of ashas and nirashas. That is, it's like a series of desires and disappointments. Similarly, he says, like sankalpas and vikalpas. So you a certain intention, and then that intention gets foiled. And so sankalpas and vikalpas. Similarly, sanyoga and viyoga. You know, people come together and then people move away, right? So Swami says that this is the essential feature of life. As we say, you know, sometimes it's not a bug, it is the feature, right? So that's how the life is designed. And so it doesn't make sense that so many of the activities which we do are essentially to, you know, run away from facing or confronting sorrow. You know, like, and we try to make our entire lives all about in pursuit of happiness. And therefore, even when sorrow touches even in a slight bit, and we get so very perturbed.
Right.
I think few segments ago we were discussing that how when we look at the present day youth, right, we notice this happening, especially in our country nowadays, that they face, at least at the middle class level or the urban level, right, they face fewer hardships than we did in our time.
Right.
And even abroad, now in the first world countries, that is becoming a problem, because it is perceived that because of this lack of challenge at a young age, and that, you know, the many of the contentment, satisfaction is like so easy to attain nowadays, right? And because of that, there's a larger incidence of depression.
Right.
And that's a very counterintuitive fact. But the fact is this, that this is happening, as some psychologists do perceive, because of that lack of challenge, which is preparing the mind, you know, for vicissitudes of various kind. Right? So when you encounter them at a young age, what happens is you also learn how to cope, how to deal with the disappointment of losing something,
right,
or even losing somebody, for example, right? So when the mind is trained that way, when it begins to learn to cope with such things, it is then that it attains like great strength. It otherwise you'll find yourself being thrown about by very small things that happen, or unpleasant things that happen in life.
Very true. In fact, they say that also emphasizes the importance of living in large families, or living in places where, even for that matter, even in a setup like an hostel, where you don't get all that you want.
Correct.
Right? You are prepared with disappointments. You're prepared to hear no every now and then.
Yes.
That actually is lacking in many of these families, where children are literally spoiled. They're given whatever they ask for, and that's when it happens. You know, at some point in your later teenage, you're not prepared to not have what you've wanted.
Exactly.
And when that happens the first time, and you're not trained to handle that at all.
Correct.
Right?
That they say is a very distinctive feature of life in our hostel, because I recall, even say, like when I was doing my MBA, we were 12 people in one room. Right, and the room, of course, did not have any air conditioning, and we all of us used to sleep on the ground. And many of my classmates, because this was the MBA class, these were people who had already been earning very good salaries outside before they were. So they were already used to a certain level of comfort, and they were so prepared to live the way we did in the hostel, because they knew it was a very important lesson. And I know, like, one of the, I had visited one of our alumni who is a CEO of a company.
Okay.
You know, so I remember I went sitting in his office, and he was a little drowsy, so he requested, you know, the office lady over there to prepare a coffee. But by the time she brought the coffee, he had already fallen asleep. I remember the confusion on her face when she comes in. She's looking for like where her boss is. She can't see. The reason is he's sleeping on the ground. When she saw that, she was so aghast, and then she looked at me. Then I said, you know, we are all Swami students. For us, it really, you know, we do not look for creature comfort. We can sleep on the ground if we need to. Right. So,
absolutely. Not only that, you know, very weird when we now look back. In that room, not only were 12 people, 6 people staying together, they are coming from different parts of the country where the weathers are completely different.
Yeah.
So, which means the needs of, you know, whether you want the fan on, you don't want it on, you want the windows open, you don't want it on, it's so different. You need to put up with all of that. Yeah. And that's when at some point, you know, you want something, but you let it go because you can't help it. You can't have your way all the time.
Right.
Right? And that is what really prepares you. And that's precisely what Swami is saying, that the sooner than later you accept this as you're saying, feature of life, not the aberration of life.
Correct.
And that's when you move forward.
Because otherwise you develop a very unrealistic, you know, idea of what life is, or what it's supposed to be about, which I think is also, which may be the cause of like so many relationships themselves being broken up, because you have such an idealistic image of what the marriage should all be about, or what the relationship, any relationship, what it should be about, instead of actually developing the attitude or the ability to deal with what is in front of you.
Right. Then the moment you accept that there will be ups and downs in the relationship.
Correct.
Then you will, otherwise, as somebody was very beautifully saying, we teach our children to make choices, but we don't teach them how to live with the choices which have been made. Right?
Yeah.
So at every time that you face with something that is unpleasant, you again go back to choice making, because that's the only thing that you've learned. You've not learned the art of living with the choices that you made.
Correct. And just as you were saying, that you should be very clear that life is full of ups and downs.
Right.
I remembered one marriage counselor. You know, he told me that most of the counseling that I do with couples who are facing such marital problems or marital discord is to actually show them that that marital discord is something that is a feature of marriage and not a bug. You know, so he says that, you know, in a very light-hearted way, he says that the couples have been brought together in order to fight. So he says what he does on a very serious level is therefore to take that significance out of the fact that they are fighting each other. He says that is the thing, that when they fight each other, they feel that something very, you know, weird has happened, or something that was not meant to happen has happened. Mm-hmm. And that's why it begins to escalate in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to an outsider it will be seem like, huh, they are mm-hmm. fighting and that's mm-hmm. about it. But in their mind, something very unnatural has taken place. He says, that is so much of my work that I take out that significance out of it and, you know, have them see the humor in the fact that they're fighting each other like, you know, two cocks. So he says that's the whole thing. And I think in one sense, of course, we are talking about a spiritual topic, but there are so many worldly, you know, parallels which help us understand what Swami is talking about. Because as Swami says over here, that the mind is the root.
Mm.
Because whatever significance, whatever weightage we give to something, and that happens only in our mind. You know, like as we were mentioning the last time, we could all be living on the same planet, but the world would appear so entirely different. Like yesterday I was driving someplace with one of our doctors, and it occurred to me, you know, like for me, when I look at traffic, for me traffic is something that is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that so I imagine that if I am behind the wheel, I would be such a safe driver and, mm-hmm. you know, take all kinds of precautions, and I'm pretty sure people would find me a very slow driver.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I see if the person has a different outlook on what, when he looks at the road and all the mm-hmm. vehicles, when what he sees is entirely different. I mm-hmm. see danger and he sees excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And that totally dictates like how the person drives, right?
Mm-hmm.
The same way with life. And because a person who sees like danger, disappointment, sorrow everywhere, they will lead their lives according to that. Not only that, they will see only sorrows, disappointment. They'll be on the lookout for where that happens.
Right.
You'll notice that, like for example, somebody, the same two people, they go to some program or some entertainment of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's the same entertainment. And yet you'll find that there'll be that one person who's always saying, no, it was hopeless, it was pathetic. While somebody else will find at least something to praise about the same thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's living in the same world, perceiving the same events, and yet coming back with such entirely different reactions at different ends of the spectrum.
And sometimes you can influence the other people's thinking also, you know. There was one of these journalists who was speaking about what's wrong with the media.
Mm.
So that time he says, let's say in some place, you know, we always hear news of a stray dog has bitten this person, a stray dog has bitten this child. That's a news which we always hear. Let's say in some place a madman is, you know, has retaliated. He's gone and bit the dog. Okay, let's say. And a journalist comes to know of that and he says, oh my God, this is the news because it's different, right? So he publishes it and he says that some of the journalists in some other part of the country will read it and say, oh, this is an interesting news. So he'll come to know of some case where another madcap has done that. So he publishes that news and he says at the end of 2-3 months, you would have heard 4 cases such as this. Then you will start thinking, oh, stray dogs have stopped biting men. Men have started biting stray dogs. He said, it's actually not the case. It's all said and done, it's a stray incident.
Yeah.
As we're saying, if you go through life thinking that there is sorrow, this is the thing, this is pain, and this is trouble, that's all we will be seeing because you're focused to see that.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the beauty is Swami saying that to be tuned like that, to see only the positive also is wrong.
Mm.
Right? If you keep seeing only the positives, then again it is not going to help you.
Correct.
To have that balanced view of there needs to be positive, there needs to be negative, there needs to be happiness, there needs to be sorrow.
Correct.
That is the balance which Swami says that we have to cultivate.
Yes, I think I really appreciate you use that word called balance.
Mm.
Because that is the theme of the Upanishads. I've been seeing like throughout, you know, through all the Upanishads that we've been seeing. And I think the most important Upanishad that would come to mind which speaks about balance is the Ishavasi Upanishad.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ishavasi Upanishad is always looking at that balance between what you call as a world and what you call as the non-world, or between Vidya and Avidya, right? So even Swami, as we would see over here, he always calls for this balance between what? Like secular knowledge and the knowledge of the Atma. He says both have to be there, And it is for us to find that balance of like how much of it in our lives, right? And in many aspects, like when we say spiritual pursuits and the worldly pursuits, and then Swami asks us to strike the right balance between the two, right? And even like many of our, you know, the way we are supposed to interact with people, right? So we would have that question called, do we use our heads or do we use our heart, the emotions? And always Swami would say it has to be a combination of the two. You cannot neglect one or the other, right? So,
I mean, opposed to contrary belief, Swami would in fact curb the use of emotion extensively.
Precisely, you know, that is people, a very, very important
thing. Some people tend to think that you always think from your heart, you always feel and do it. There are many times Swami has cut that, you know, especially in front of him, if you try to become too emotional, Swami would say, no, you know, be practical, be this one. Yes, you should be inspired by what is the feeling that you have, and that's important.
Yeah.
And Swami himself says that I'm a bhavapriya, I go behind the intentions and feelings.
Correct.
But Swami says that where your reasoning has to be used, it has to be used in that place.
Yes, and that is very, very, very counterintuitive to people who may not have really explored, you know, how Swami used to interact with his devotees and with his students. It's very important for people to note that Swami was one person who would always have us use the rational part of our minds to the fullest. Like, you know, you couldn't go to him, for example, and say something like or relate an incident where you yourself have not examined it from all points of view to say whether it is right or wrong. Or some statement which you would make, Swami would always ask, how do you know that? Why is it so? You know, he would persuade us to speak. It's not like, you know, like speaking from the gut or something you feel is true. That's not what Swami used to encourage. He's always used to have us find out why we thought it was true.
In fact, I was listening to an interview of Dana Gillespie. She makes this very beautiful point. I think it's something which can be practically kept in our mind, you know. And she would say that when she would sing in Swami's presence, people who listen will say, oh, you're singing so much devotion and so much feeling. She would say, there's no devotion, there's no feeling. Because if I sing with devotion, I can't stop crying.
Right.
And if I start crying, I can't sing. So she says, I don't do that. I try to keep my emotions under control.
Correct.
And she makes a very beautiful point. She says, when I'm practicing, when I'm at home and I'm alone, I sing to Swami. But there in Kulwantol, I sing for Swami. So I keep my emotions under control.
Right.
She says, when I'm standing there and I'm singing for Swami, I need to give the best in terms of quality. But when I'm singing for myself, I mean, all by myself, I'm singing to Swami, I mean, I don't hold myself back. I can, you know, cry my heart out and with emotion. And she said that that becomes the basis of the performance I give in front of others, but there is no, you know, that mushiness inside where I'm performing in front of an audience.
No, but in that, in the sense, is true devotion, because there you're being in tune with what Swami expects you to do.
Right.
And very clearly, Swami doesn't expect that, you know, you stand over there and completely break down, not be able to perform or not satisfy the audience in the first place, right? So that is actually the true devotion, where you are in touch with what Swami wants. And many times, because of that, your emotions may not be giving you the right indication of why, you know, of what Swami wants. So what life itself wants.
Right.
See, because one thing, the way we operate is like that, right? Because what triggers us, we ourselves are not in control of that. Like, we are not, we are not in control of our first reaction to something. Right? And that's why it's very important for us to temper that reaction and again have a look at, you know, what is required at this moment and then respond appropriately. So they make that distinction between what your reaction is. And oftentimes you have absolutely no control over your reaction. But discrimination, what Viveka, that faculty of Viveka which Swami speaks about, and which is why, as you were saying, sadhana is very, it is very important, because we have to keep exercising that muscle of Viveka, of discrimination, from time to time. Otherwise, what will happen is our natural reactions will take over.
Right.
Which will not allow us to respond appropriately.
Absolutely. In fact, the point which Swami is making, especially when he's talking about the mind, and he's saying that the mind is what makes you what you are, you need to remember that. Going back to the same example of, you know, exercising that muscle, of discrimination. The point is, there will be times when you don't have control over your emotions
right.
and your reactions.
Right.
The whole idea of sadhana in that sense is, or even to be sticking to a dharmic life, if you look at it, in everyday life, you know, what am I supposed to do? Is this the right thing to do at this time? Swami would say that, you know, there are desha kala paristhiti, Swami would say that you have to do what you have to do at that particular given time. And you could be doing an absolutely right thing, but if it's not done at the right time, it becomes counterproductive. Mm. So that thing of doing what has to be done at the right time, and Swami would say that you do it when you're not under pressure. Not always we are in a confrontation, not always we are in a situation where we are pushed to the corner. So you constantly use this discrimination when you're not under pressure, so that when moments come when you're actually going to be reactive, you will react in the right manner. You
yes.
will react in the manner which is still dharmic, even though you're not having the time to pause and think and, you know, sort it out in your discrimination.
And which is why, you know, the army would be a very prime example of something like this. So the army, they always are training their soldiers and always have them be at their best, at their peak physical performance. And always, you know, I recently went through cantonment areas in the north of India, which are very close to some of our neighboring countries. And I was looking at the kind of posters that they keep. So they always, they highlight the pride of serving the country. They highlight the virtue of sacrifice, right? So these are conversations that they always keep alive, because, you know, you cannot suddenly think of sacrifice when you're out there in the war. It has to be something that has to be ingrained in you. You should be trained to think in a certain way, because then the automatic response on the battlefield is therefore of sacrifice, of bravery, and of serving the nation.
True.
Those come front, you know, instead of starting to think about, like, my mortality, what will I go through, right? So it's, as you said, it's pretty much the same thing. Like, at every stage, therefore, Swami is encouraging us to have that discrimination power alive. And because it should then shine, come through when you need it the most, when your character is tested the most.
And that's the point Swami ends with. Probably we'll also end with that point, where Swami says all of sadhana is to ensure that every thought becomes sacred.
Right.
As much as it is in your control, that which is beyond your control happens slowly. I think over a period of time that will happen, but at least what is in your control, Swami would often say that if you look at somebody, feel good things for them. You know, even if that person has been unfair to you, can you feel good things for that person? Of course, the person's unfair to you, we don't spontaneously feel it. But at least normal people, you know, when Swami says that if somebody is doing well in life, feel happy for him or her, you know, feel happy for what they're going through. Because end of the day, you need to feel happy for everybody. Swami says, love all, serve all, or samasta loka sukhino bhavantu. Well, if you can't be that way to neutral people and to people who have been good to you, you're never going to be able to do that for people who are, you know, have not been good to you. In that sense. So I think we'll leave it at that. We'll continue this discourse next week, dear listeners. We most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you all for joining us. Do join us again next week for the continuation of the discourse. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guest for the Vahini Satsang, the last episode of Thursday Live. Do join us again next week at 7:30 for the continuation of this discourse on Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam.